You were going to tell me about these pictures.
I got them from Michael Makara.
And he is whom, exactly?
My predecessor on Lang's memoirs.
He resigned?
No, he died.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes, a couple of weeks ago, he drove up here to see you. And he died a few hours afterwards.
He drove up to see me? No, I'm afraid you're mistaken. How did he die?
He drowned.
Oh, poor fellow.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old late Oxford economist Martin Summers, Kevin Carhill, and me, Tony Gosling. US assassins in Yemen. While Trump is trying to excuse the Saudis, the American have been assassinating people in Yemen for years. We ask why Algeria is banning face veils. Is it just to aid the old facial recognition software, just like other nations? And 70 years after the end of World War II, facts coming to light about dirty deals for enriched uranium done with the Nazis in the closing days of the war. And the first week after VE Day for Nazi nuclear bomb detonator technology. We hear from author of the book Nazi International, Joseph Farrell, on this and the organisations set up by Vice President Harry Truman, who took over from Roosevelt. That is the National Security Agency, the CIA, and the National Security Council. Roosevelt didn't want to use the atom bomb against population centres, and he keeled over and died. We start this week with this extraordinary story from BuzzFeed News. Martin, you sent it to me, and actually it's one of those unputdownable reads. The actual headline is just called American Mercenaries, a Middle East monarchy hired American ex-soldiers to kill its political enemies. This could be the future of war. Now, a fascinating article, but can you just sum it up for us?
Well, I mean, these guys are mercenaries. They're ex-US special forces. I mean, you've now got like maybe 70 to 100,000 of these guys. And, you know, they retire from the military officially, and then they get used on these hit squad missions.
It sounds like a sort of privatisation of war.
Well, so,
we've heard that NATO apparently has got no ground troops in Afghanistan. But, of course, there's a similar sort of thing going on there, I imagine, with mercenaries being used.
Well, they have got ground troops in Afghanistan, but they've got loads and loads of mercenaries as well.
They're not actually fighting. They're there.
Well,
they're not fighting, they say.
It's what's really interesting, this is a hit squad trying to assassinate politicians and religious leaders. Yeah? There's no suggestion that they're taking out terrorists. They're taking out politicians and religious leaders, which the UAE leadership don't like, and of course they don't have elections in the UAE, and they employ American mercenaries to go in there and do their dirty work for them. And of course a lot of the Saudi so-called coalition fighting in Yemen is made up of mercenaries from all over the world, from Colombia, from the US, from Britain. And, you know, that they are in there basically wasting Yemen on our behalf and with our support. And of course, Theresa May has got nothing to say about any of this, other than carry on the good work.
The company that hired the soldiers and carried out the attack, this specific attack they're talking about, is Spear Operations Group, incorporated in Delaware and founded by Abraham Golan, a charismatic Hungarian Israeli security contractor. I mean, how can he be Hungarian Israeli security contractor?
Well, he's originally from Hungary, but he's got Israeli citizenship because of Jewish heritage, presumably.
And, is this the Jewish mafia here?
Well, that's not the Jewish mafia. He is basically a mercenary hitman who happens to have Israeli citizenship, I presume. And, of course, the Israelis are very heavily involved in the mercenary trade. I mean, lots of their guys are involved in all sorts of security, like ICTS security systems, controlled all three airports on 9/11 and Schiphol, where the underpants bomber and the shoe bomber got onto the plane without being checked.
So anyway,
that's all Israeli mercenary stuff.
Abraham Golan has been very open with BuzzFeed. He says there was a targeted assassination program in Yemen. I was running it. We did it. It was sanctioned by the UAE within the coalition. The UAE and Saudi Arabia led an alliance of 9 countries in Yemen fighting what's largely a proxy war against Iran. The US is helping the Saudi UAE side by providing weapons, intelligence and other support. Now, we're told, Kevin, that actually what's going on in Yemen is an insurgency led by the Iranians.
I've never been able to work it out clearly, but that's probably a good approximation. The Iranians are backing their side of Islam. Is that Shia or...?
The Shias.
Yeah, and the Saudis are backing the other. This is like the wars of the 16th century in Europe, you know, the religious wars. And we're not getting a clear picture because it's not being explained.
The revelations, says BuzzFeed, that a Middle East monarchy hired Americans to carry out assassinations comes at a moment when the world is focused on the alleged murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi Arabia, an autocratic regime that has close ties to both the US and UAE. The Saudi embassy, they say, in the US won't respond to requests for comment. Riyadh has denied it killed Khashoggi, although news reports suggest it's considering blaming the death on a botched interrogation. Now, do you think that's a flyer, Kevin?
The Saudis have bluffed and, you know, told lies for 14 days. And the only people sort of countering the lies are the Turks. All the exposure of Saudi Arabia and its disgusting involvement in this. I mean, the poor man was grabbed. He had his fingers pulled off. Then he was stabbed and then he had his head cut off. Wow. I mean, the savagery of it.
I mean, what evidence have you got for that? Because
it's from the Turks.
Trump is calling for the at least the Americans to be allowed to hear the surveillance tape, which the Turks are saying this contains this information, but it's not been made public, has it?
Well, I think, you know, for me as an outsider, there's a perfect picture of Khashoggi going into there, going into the embassy. The Saudis say he left. Well, where's the picture?
I think that's right. I mean, the Turks, basically, don't forget, they're pro-Muslim Brotherhood. And Khashoggi was drifting in that direction. And the Muslim Brotherhood is regarded by the Saudis as a threat, basically, because they've got a different... You know, they basically, the Muslim Brotherhood, could be the leaders of the Sunni Islam faction, if you like. And the Saudis feel terribly threatened by that. And Khashoggi was an insider, don't forget.
Yeah.
He used to work very closely with Turki bin Faisal, who was, of course, the guy who used to work with Osama bin Laden and also eventually became ambassador to Britain. So Khashoggi as some kind of dissident is a bit overwrought, but it doesn't matter. In any case, they shouldn't be going around killing people in this fashion.
Okay. Spear Operation Group's private assassination mission marks the confluence of three developments transforming the way war is conducted worldwide. But this is what I love about what BuzzFeed have done here, is that they're really, you know, taking a long step back from it, saying, what does this really teach us about what's really going on in the world? Modern counter-terrorism, they say, has shifted away from traditional military objectives, such as destroying airfields, gun emplacements and barracks, to killing specific individuals, largely reshaping war into an assassination program. So really you're talking about, rather than attacking groups of people, countries, factions, you just kill the leaders, and then hopefully, I suppose, that means that the organization becomes leaderless, rudderless, or whatever. Then they also say wars become increasingly privatized, with many nations outsourcing most military support and services to private contractors, leaving frontline combat as virtually the only function. The US and many other militaries have not contracted out to for-profit ventures. Now, this idea, both of you, I'll ask you this, about the idea of the for-profit sector moving increasingly into these military conflicts, and also completely covered by secrecy. The other thing it does is it's a cutout, isn't it? So that the big organisations like the army, intelligence services can say, oh, well, it's nothing to do with us.
Yeah. But it is history repeating itself. Ever heard of the East India Company? That was wholly privatised warfare for the empire. the British troops were hardly employed in India. It was entirely mercenary, the East India Company. But the other thing, go back to your bumping off the leaders, pure Kitson. Frank Kitson strikes again. So it's not novel.
Well, Kitson, of course, was the theoretician of low intensity warfare, gangs and counter gangs, and it's very clear. I mean, there is clearly some case to be made that you can, by targeted assassinations, disrupt organisations that you want to disrupt, whether they're political parties or whatever. Ultimately, of course, though, you still have to fight the big wars. I mean, in Syria, if it comes to a real, there's been lots of assassination and so on, but if it comes to a real fight, it'll be air forces versus ground based and sea based missiles and so on. So I mean, assassination and privatisation have become very central to the way the modern way of war, but that's been going on for a long time. It's just become more intensified.
Sorry, Kevin. No, just think about the drone warfare. Mass murder by drone. You know, some Burke sitting in Ohio kills whole families in Afghanistan, the Yemen, or wherever.
Or RAF Warrington in Lincolnshire. I think, actually, isn't it Ramstein in Germany, which is one of the main hubs for the drone warfare programme?
Yeah.
I mean, really, Martin, let's take another step back from all this, because what we're really looking at here is a complete breakdown in international law, isn't it? There's no rule of law. If you want to interfere in a country, so long as you do it covertly, you pay private mercenaries to do it, no one's going to stop you.
Well, it's been going on for a long time. And, of course, the United States is increasingly withdrawing from all international organisations, which might, in some theoretical universe, hold them to account. So they've never joined the International Criminal Court, for example. They're quite keen for the International Criminal Court to prosecute people they don't like Slobodan Milosevic, but they're not prepared to join it because they don't want to be answerable in any way for what they do.
And the Americans can also say
they're basically, they're not the world's policemen, they're the world's gangsters, and that's been increasingly obvious.
The Americans can also say, can't they, if they wish to, maybe they do this. They'll say, oh, well, it's nothing to do with us. Although it's American soldiers being used, ex-soldiers, this is all being done by the UAE. Nothing to do with us, Governor.
They would, but they'd also be wrong, because in actual fact the UAE is working very closely with them to get these people done in. They wouldn't be allowed to do it if the US government didn't want it to happen. And as you said earlier, it's about having cutouts, isn't it? I mean, what amazes me about the guys who've confessed to all of this is what they mostly vaguely worry about is somebody eventually prosecuting them for what they've done. And what I would say to the people like that is what you possibly need to think about is some of the people you've been whacking, maybe they're going to come around to your house and whack you. If there's no rules, mate, maybe there's no rules for you too.
I will put up a link to this BuzzFeed article on our show page. I suppose we should do a sort of article of the week thing, really. We've been doing the Israeli cabinet for a while, and maybe we should get back to doing that as well. But this really is, for me, you know, I don't understand why this an article like this can hit the internet, and yet there's virtually nobody in the world picks up on it, Kevin.
Yeah, it is. This is the you've partly talked about it. Deniability. The United States says it's not us, even if all the assassins have American accents. It's the UAE. Ain't us, brother. But one of the things I noticed was that in that article, the competence of the assassins was about at the same level of the GRU guys in Salisbury. You know, utterly incompetent. Didn't know whether they were shooting each other, shooting their target. It was extraordinary.
And of course, if they're really fighting a well armed opposition like the Taliban in Afghanistan, or the local boys know everything that's going on locally, these guys are good at shooting people. They don't speak any Arabic. They have to be pointed to the targets. They don't even know why they're being killed. And ultimately, of course, that's militarily incompetent.
Kevin, you've been in the military, in the Irish Army and the British Army. So this is, I find it fascinating you talking about this as the East India Company. I mean, what? So what happened in the meantime? Did we have some sort of period in the interim where this wasn't happening? Because this is going back almost to sort of a pre or post medieval system.
It is. After the mutiny in the 1870s in India, the British state took over. and it became the empire, and it was all government run. Now we're going back to what it was before that, you know, where each country hired its mercenary armies, in this case its mercenary assassins. We are repeating history, and it's going to be very messy.
I think, you know, what we should do is we should have a little bit more on the East India Company before the end of the programme, because this is, you know, a fascinating period of history. Mm. And in a way, it's when the world order breaks down of one sort or another, whether it's United Nations, League of Nations, it kind of reverts to this social Darwinism, basically. Yeah. We're talking about the strong survive, and it's the law. It goes back to being like the law of the jungle, and we really ought to be flagging that up and trying to do something to stop it. Anyway, Martin, I think what we'll do now is we'll go to Prime Minister's questions, where the perennial issue of Israel and Palestine came up again. This time it was to do with the destruction of villages by some of the Israeli settlers. So let's have a listen to that now.
Alistair Carmichael.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Bedouin community of Khan al-Ahmar in the occupied Palestinian territories faces imminent demolition and is currently being swamped with sewage from the nearby settlement of Kfar Adumin. Just this morning, Israeli forces have tasered and pepper sprayed activists there. Will the Prime Minister make it clear to the Prime Minister of Israel that this is occupied territory, that these are refugees, protected people, whose forcible removal would be, as the United Nations has stated, constitute a war crime?
Can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that my Right Honourable friend, the Minister for the Middle East, met the Israeli ambassador on the 11th of October. He made clear the deep concerns that the UK has about Israel's planned demolition of the village of Khan al-Ahmar. Its demolition would be a major blow for the prospects of a two-state solution with Jerusalem as a shared capital. And I once again call on the Israeli government not to go ahead with its plan to demolish the village, including its school, and displace its residents.
Well, it's good to hear Theresa May for once saying something sensible. But, I mean, the British position is not the same as the US position. And, of course, the Israelis follow the US position. What the British think, they don't really care about.
No, it's actually tragic. I mean, Labour have just suffered an unnecessary crisis over anti-Zionism. And what the people attacking Labour over anti-Semitism... tried to impose on everybody was, if you criticise Israel, you're anti-Semitic. That is not so. I wrote to Rabbi Sachs, the Lord Sachs, and said, I'm ex-British Army. I know, as a matter of experience, when you're allowed to shoot. And our army, by and large, with a few exceptions, never shot unarmed civilians. And if they had, the ceiling would have fallen in. So you can't. I'm thinking of the Palestinians who are being shot at the border. If our troops, if British troops shot unarmed civilians on that scale, the entire ceiling would fall in. And it's not anti-Semitic to say that kind of conduct is totally unacceptable. It is actually mass murder. Armed troops shooting unarmed people, it's catastrophic.
Isn't it also cowardly?
Sorry?
Isn't it also cowardly?
Well, I mean, what else do you describe somebody with a gun who shoots somebody with no gun? It's murder. It's beyond cowardice. It's criminal.
It's going for the easy targets, isn't it? And not
yeah.
to actually fight. Yeah. Also, staying with the whole Jerusalem and the Middle East business, anger this week over the Australian Prime Minister's comments about Jerusalem just days before the crucial vote. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison sparked outrage by suggesting Canberra was open to recognising Jerusalem as Israel's capital and possibly moving its embassy there. Mr. Morrison's comments came out of the blue just 4 days before a crunch by-election in an area with a large Jewish population, fueling claims that domestic politics are behind his sudden shift in position. The by-elections in the Sydney Harbour side Hillside seat of Wentworth. Obviously, the Royals are over there too at the moment. But the Australian Prime Minister, it seems, is going to follow Donald Trump, Martin.
Yeah, well, the Australian right wing are a pretty reprehensible bunch, frankly. I mean, in the run-up to the Iraq war, every single Commonwealth country voted against military action in Iraq. That included New Zealand, South Africa, Pakistan, India. But the only country that supported Britain's intervention in Iraq was Australia under a right-wing government. And they are very pro-American, they're very right-wing, and they're proud of their rednecked attitude. But of course, they're totally isolated.
We hear this week, in fact, I think this is just today, Putin is unveiling 1,000 more cutting-edge hypersonic missiles, more destructive than the American ones. Vladimir Putin's cranking up, this is in the Express, the Russian war machine further still, with a massive investment in more than 1,000 hypersonic long-range missiles capable of blowing planes out of the sky over a range of hundreds of miles, giving him an edge over the United States. Russian media report the Ministry of Defense have signed off on an acquisition of the 4DN6. I think that's this, the long-range surface-to-air missiles, which are capable of hitting hostile jets and even hypersonic cruise missiles, which travel at more than half a mile a second. Reports suggest the Russian armed forces plan to buy more than 1,000 of these for their state-of-the-art S-400 Triumph anti-ground-to-air missile system. Martin.
Well, I mean, since the Russians have been told endlessly by the West that they are the enemy and that eventually they're going to have to be confronted and they've got to, you know, we've got to stand up to them, they've obviously taken that to heart and they're preparing for World War III as they should. I mean, they'd be totally irresponsible if they didn't. And the fact of the matter is what they're hoping is by getting properly prepared, the West will be too intimidated to start it. But of course, that's not necessarily the case.
It's actually much simpler than that. What stops war right now, unfortunately, is the nuclear deterrent. There is no chance that if Russia attacked anywhere, nuclear weapons would be more than 7 days away. There's no chance of an attack. The second thing is the West is very big on propaganda, but the West has no efficient troops to meet a Russian assault if one occurred. So, you know, the whole thing is just fiction. It's all this Russia's the enemy and the Russians are arming themselves. All the arms race in missiles and things has been a constant for the last 60 years. Nothing new. Each side improves its weapons. Nothing happens, except the taxpayers get robbed. And the West does not have conventional forces to stop a Russian assault. The only thing is, there isn't going to be a Russian assault, because behind the West's lack of preparation are nuclear weapons.
Well, interesting on that point, the US ambassador to NATO this week was saying that if the Russians don't get rid of a certain class of missile which they've been developing, they will be taken out by NATO. In other words, threatening a specific first strike. Also, another politician in the US has said that they could blockade Russia's ports, which of course you could, but that's an act of war and you're going to war if you do that. I don't actually see that. I think there is a possibility of a conventional war between the West and Russia in which nuclear weapons aren't used. I think it's possible, but it'll be very messy and extremely violent.
I mean, obviously we're talking about Russia. You can't really talk about the Russians without talking about the Skripal story. Bellingcat's been a bit quiet this week, but the previous 2 weeks he's been making a lot of noise. I noticed that he is. There are two organisations that we can see over the last few years that have been paying his salary. One is the Atlantic Council and the other is Google. So, I mean,
the idea that he's an independent journalist is a bit laughable,
well,
isn't it?
Isn't it okay for Google to say, I mean, maybe Google might knock on our door here at the Eastern Community Centre one day, Martin, and say, well, okay, we like your programme, we're going to sponsor it, we're going to pay your salary?
No, I don't think that's going to happen, though, is it?
Atlantic Council is chaired by a former American Defence Secretary.
So, what is the Atlantic Council, Kevin?
It's a bunch of American right-wing ex-military officials. They pretend to believe in the Atlantic Alliance, and it's just another way of pressuring Europe.
Facebook has been, apparently the Atlantic Council has been handing names of websites and stories to, this is according to Global Research, actually that's just this week that's come out, okay. That article, Facebook has been censoring its content depending on what the Atlantic Council tells it to censor.
Yeah, well, I mean, all this stuff about, you know, the Russians hacking the election and so on has led to Google and Facebook saying, oh, yes, we've been very naughty boys. Now we're going to reform this to make sure that people aren't allowed to have freedom of speech on our platforms. And it's all mind manipulation by security services.
Actually, I think it was Felicity Arbuthnot sent me an email with this article this week. It's a terrific article. It really explains how Facebook is basically doing what groups like the Atlantic Council, who we've never even heard of on the BBC, tell them to, Kevin.
Well, the intriguing thing is that nobody seems to have noticed, but our Parliament has described, in Hansard, described Facebook as a criminal corporation. We can stick with that. They are. And, you know, their particular criminal links to the American spooks, you know, passed
in front of Congress. Oh, Mark Zuckerberg was looking a bit shiftier earlier in the year, wasn't he?
Well, think of it, he didn't even turn up here because he's scared somebody will say, what about your spying in the UK?
So if he comes to Britain, is he going to be arrested at the Heathrow airport and dragged to a Commons committee?
No, but he should be asked that key question: why are you spying on our kids? And where does the question come from Hansard? Evidence published by the House of Commons Select Committee.
So what's the latest on all your efforts to get this through the courts, Kevin?
I've decided on a strategy. The first case against Facebook, the new one, started last week. I actually sent the documents. I have pointed out to the Irish Supreme Court that they have just granted an appeal right to what our Parliament thinks is a criminal corporation. And I don't know what they're making of it, but they've been very quiet.
Anyway, this article from Felicity, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's on Global Research. It's called Facebook Censorship and the Atlantic Council. She says, what the article says, what very few people know is that 5 months ago, Facebook announced it was officially partnering with the Atlantic Council in the form of an election partnership to prevent their service from being abused during elections. Indeed, the US midterm elections are only a couple of weeks away, so the Atlantic Council and its digital forensic research lab are now going at it with full force, closing Facebook accounts left and right that they personally deem could be fake accounts or accounts spreading misinformation based on very shady criteria. Now, Martin, one of the criteria that they use is they say that it could be Russian bots that are using these accounts. And rather cleverly, some of the people on RT have pointed out, yes, but the trouble is 90% of these so-called Russian bots are botting away in the Russian language, not something that could be targeted against American voters.
Well, I think a lot of this stuff is frankly ludicrous, but it's become a kind of meme that's running around in the political classes, both sides of the Atlantic, that the Russians are fixing elections by sitting there on their computers and blogging. Now, in actual fact, Russian elections are being rigged, but they're not being rigged by the Russians. They're being rigged by our own intelligence services, and the ludicrousness of the allegations shows that. I mean, we've said before that Bellingcat last week was going on about the Russians hacking the US election. And all the evidence that the Democratic primaries were rigged came from emails which were a leak to WikiLeaks via Craig Murray. There was no computer hacking involved. But of course it does show that the elections were rigged, not by the Russians, but by the US secret services. They rigged the elections.
This is a terrific article. As a paragraph I hadn't spotted before, it says, one doesn't need to look far to understand who the Atlantic Council are and what they stand for. It's a think tank funded by NATO, weapons manufacturers, Middle Eastern oil state monarchies, billionaires, and different branches of the US military. In short, it's been described as being nothing less than NATO's unofficial propaganda wing. The Atlantic Council doesn't shy away from its political interests around the world, which can be seen solely by looking at who sits on its director's board. The creme de la creme when it comes to US neocons and war criminals. Henry Kissinger, Condoleezza Rice, Frank Carlucci, James A. Baker, George Shultz, James Woolsey, Leon Panetta, Colin Powell, Robert Gates, and many, many more.
That's right, and it's, don't forget, folks, it's your taxes that are paid to the military-industrial complex, which then tells Facebook what you're not and what you're not allowed to think about. And therefore, our taxes are being used to bamboozle us.
Do you remember Colin Powell standing there with the some sort of Niger uranium cake that he said that Saddam Hussein had? It was just lying through his teeth.
Yeah, that's right. And they don't get caught.
It's been smothered out by the PR and the propaganda, but everybody forgets that Facebook, and it was described as a criminal corporation in the House of Commons evidence, because it has a contract with the National Security Agency, the biggest of the American spook organizations, and they are spying on 67% of all internet users in the UK as we speak. And it is criminal, according to the parliamentary evidence. I mean, how did that get lost in the... But there is...
I must say, lots of love and a great big thank you to Felicity Arbuthnot for sending me this. It's absolutely fascinating to see an article arrive in your inbox just at the right time to help you understand what's going on. That list, Martin, is pretty incredible, isn't it? That this is who the Atlantic Council are. Facebook are partnering with them. And Bellingcat is one of their little protégés.
Well, that's right, and that's what we're dealing with. Bellingcat is supposed to be as you said the other week, he's a counter gang for Julian Assange. So he looks a bit like...
Assange is allowed to grow. He does his thing. He starts to really challenge some of the big intelligence agencies to be a massively powerful anti-war force. Then he's shut down, and this Bellingcat pops up almost as if he's doing the same job, but actually he's working for the guys that Assange was trying to take out.
That's right. It's coming back to Kitson. That is a counter gang. Yeah. So you create something that looks like the Mau Mau, but it ain't the Mau Mau.
I think this is going to sound very odd coming from me, but there's somebody that keeps getting overlooked. He's called Damien Collins. He's a Tory MP. He's chair of the Digital and Media Committee. He's intervened twice recently. He published the evidence describing Facebook as a criminal corporation. Last Sunday, he said, why haven't the police investigated your own local fraudsters in the Brexit thing? And he was very edgy about it. The police were given... evidence by the Electoral Commission, and they have refused to investigate. And it was Damien Collins who raised it, not any of the usual culprits. So somebody knows something. I mean, we are just being bamboozled. Okay.
Another article here. This is on Mint Press News. This is about, and it's wonderful, good old Mint Press News. I think they're one of the people that Prop or Not said is fake news, but we love them. They have a whole section on AFRICOM, which never is mentioned on the BBC or any of the mainstream press. What is AFRICOM, Martin?
Well, the US military has basically carved the world up into areas where they believe they've got to have full control of everything. So AFRICOM is supposed to control Africa. And, of course, no African countries wanted to have AFRICOM because they don't particularly want AFRICOM to exist. So it was based at Ramstein in Germany. And I think it's actually also based now in South Africa as well. But it means basically it's the US military's intervention in Africa. And they're intervening very strongly all over Africa.
Well, okay,
they're supporting rebels and so on. And then they're also intervening to try...
That's what this article is about. It's entitled, "The US Military is All Over Africa Despite Not Being at War." There are currently roughly 7,500 US military personnel, including 1,000 contractors, deployed in Africa. For comparison, that figure was only 6,000 just a year ago. Now, Kevin, I thought Donald Trump got elected because he said, actually, we need to rein back this war on terror, didn't he?
He did, but... what he said to get himself elected and what he's doing in power are two very different things. Trump is not going to change the American approach to effectively universal domination if he can get away with it. We don't understand that the empire now, the evil empire, is the United States, based on its actions, not the propaganda.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
One of these days, it'll work. BCFM 93.2. Anyway, we're going to have a listen now to an interview, which is really underlining what Kevin's saying there, about the links between the Nazis and the United States, which really started right at the end of the Second World War. And here is a clip from Joseph Farrell, who is the author of The Nazi International, talking about why there was not enough U-235, that's enriched uranium, available in America to actually make the atom bomb at the end of the Second World War. So where did they get the extra bit from, one wonders?
In 1944, in the United States, the chief metallurgist for the Manhattan Project, for our atomic bomb project, a fellow by the name of Eric Jetta, mm-hmm. In December of 1944, on the very day that the Battle of the Bulge begins, sends a memorandum stating that the stocks of fissionable uranium that the United States has will not reach critical mass stockpile until sometime in November of 1945. Now stop right there, because the little boy bomb that the United States dropped on Hiroshima on August 6th of 1945 was a uranium bomb. So where did the extra uranium come from? You see? Now, this leads us to the Germans, because as I point out in the Nazi International, what I think happened, and I'm skipping enormous amounts of detail here, folks, and I hope you appreciate this. This scenario takes a whole chapter for me to lay out in the Nazi International. But what I think happened was that Bormann negotiated secretly with the United States through his military intelligence that was in contact with Alan Dulles in Switzerland, to turn over to the United States a stockpile of U-235 yellow cake. In other words, this is the final form of U-235 before it's metallicized for fuel in a bomb. This U-235 was making its way by U-boat, accompanied by two Japanese military officers, that was going to be transferred to Japan. Okay? I think Bormann negotiated the surrender of that uranium to the United States.
Yeah, this is consistent with, if you like, the hidden history of the end of the war. The Germans had built long-range U-boats, you know, for intercontinental travel, and they had gone a long way towards creating a bomb.
Well, you Irish know quite a lot about U-boats, don't you? Because you were refueling some of them, I do believe.
That is utter B. You can't... To refuel a U-boat, you'd need more than your local, you know, pig farmer. It was very, very hard.
I mean, weren't there open links? I don't want to press you too much on this, Kevin.
No,
weren't there open links at the beginning of World War II with German ships coming and going, you know, with armaments and that sort of thing in the Irish Republic?
No, not particularly. There was one of the IRA men, I can't remember his name, was, you know, went to Germany, and he was like a kind of Lord Haw-Haw, and he tried, as some of our own United Kingdom folks, he tried to recruit a kind of Irish Nazi legion, but he never succeeded. I mean, most people in Ireland had a fair idea what the Nazis were up to, and were not waiting with open arms to welcome Adolf Hitler.
Okay. Also, we did cover this. We have covered this partly before. Before we hear from Martin, we hear a bit more from Joseph Farrell with the book by Carter Heydrich called Critical Mass, which really does go into this whole story in quite a lot of depth. But we're here again from Joseph Farrell now, where he talks about this U-boat. It's a bit confusing, because the uranium is U-235, that's enriched uranium, and that's its atomic number. But you've also got a U-boat, which is U-234, which is the one less number, but that's the actual designation, you know, numbers on the side of the U-boat. And he picks up the story about this U-boat heading for Japan now.
You had the flights of these long-range Junkers 290s and 390s making their way out of Europe as well.
With a bell in, maybe.
With the bell, I think, you know, Kammler and all of this stuff. Messerschmitt 264s and Focke-Wulf 200s, you know, these were all long-range four-engine aircraft. Junkers 390 was a six-engine aircraft. But, you know, they certainly had the aircraft to make these heavy lift, long flights. Now, what happened to the U-boat is interesting because the U-234 makes its way across the Northern Atlantic. It dodges Canadian and British naval forces and gets in contact with the United States Navy. The United States jams the radio signals of our Canadian allies so that we can find this U-boat first. And when the U-boat captain announces his intention to his crew with the two Japanese officers on board that he's going to surrender the U-boat and its contents to the Americans, well, the Japanese commit harakiri. The U-boat surrenders to the United States, and here's where it gets very interesting, okay, as if it weren't interesting enough so far. When the U-boat surrenders to the United States, it's told to make for Portsmouth, Maine. Once it reaches Portsmouth, Maine, the entire crew, of course, is taken prisoner, and the contents of the U-boat are inventoried. And the contents include not only 80 gold-lined cylinders full of uranium-235 yellow cake, okay, but they also include, and this is so vitally important, they also include 25 infrared fuses, plus their inventor, a fellow by the name of Dr. Heinz Schlicke, all right? He is taken to the Pentagon, where he debriefs American military brass under the chairmanship of a, quote, Mr. Alvarez, who I think is Dr. Luis Alvarez, one of the Manhattan Project atomic bomb scientists, who incidentally, guess what, goes on to win the Nobel Prize for solving the fusion, or pardon me, the implosion fuse system for a plutonium bomb. Now,
interesting timing, huh?
Oh, yeah, interesting. Ain't that interesting? Because the American atomic bomb scientists had run into the nasty mathematical fact that in order to make plutonium go critical and create an atomic explosion, you had to compress that core in under, symmetrically, in under 3/1000th of a second. Okay? And we did not have the fuse technology to do it. But infrared proximity fuses are a handy thing to have around if you want to compress a plutonium core for your bomb. And guess what we laid our hands on with that U-boat, along with the fuse's inventor? So in other words, it's looking to me like what Bormann did is he surrendered to the United States all of the needed components to finish its uranium bomb way ahead, months ahead of the November date that Eric Jett stated in his memo of December 1944. And in addition, he surrendered 25 functioning infrared proximity fuses, which, you know, are going to fire at the speed of light and therefore solve your compression problem. And in addition, the guy that invented these fuses is briefing American Pentagon brass under the chairmanship of Luis Alvarez, who wins the Nobel Prize for solving the plutonium compression problem. So in other words, yeah, it's looking to me like we have a really clear case here that the Nazi atom bomb project was not the failure that we've been told in, you know, in our standard histories. If anything, it's the reverse.
So that's Joseph Farrell there, author of the book The Nazi International. Kevin,
you ever heard of Red October, the surrender of a Soviet nuclear submarine? But there's another story. Again, it's not a story. At the moment, they are trying to recover the Norwegian heavy water that was the Norwegians destroyed the heavy water plant, but they also sunk a boatload of heavy water on its way to Germany. You get these facts, but nobody ever ties them together and says, where was the German atomic bomb project? How big was it? And what was the literature is missing.
Well, it was amazing that actually there was a Daily Mirror, was one of the British papers, that revealed some declassified documents where Germans were interviewed and they gave evidence of two Nazi atomic tests during World War II. But that didn't get anywhere near, I think it was an article in the Mail and an article in the Mirror, didn't get anywhere near the sort of coverage that it probably should have done. Anyway, let's go to our final clip with Joseph Farrell now, which is where he talks about what happened when Truman took over from Roosevelt and his amazing I suppose it was a bit of fun he was having in 1947 when he created all these various different organisations, the CIA, the NSA, the National Security Council, and then he brought some of the top bankers in to be part of those intelligence services.
President Truman, you know, he comes into office quite literally, you know, but not expecting to come into office, but Roosevelt dies and he's confronted with all of these, quite bluntly, all of these security risks that Roosevelt tolerated. Mm. So Truman institutes his loyalty review board, and this is what really kind of gets McCarthy started. But the other thing that Truman does that I don't think people have really picked up on and realized the sweeping significance of is that in the same year of 1947, right after he's established the CIA and the NSA and the National Security Council and all these intelligence think tanks and groups, the other thing he does is he decides to recover all of that Japanese loot and keep it a state secret. In other words, what Truman did in 1947 is he put the American intelligence apparatus into the banking business.
Right.
And created a, you know, we're not even talking the black budget here. The black budget in the United States is all of these funds that Congress appropriates and simply turns over to the military and turns over to the intelligence agencies to do whatever they want to do with. Okay.
Yeah, but that's kind of on the books, isn't it? The black budget.
That's kind of on the books.
Yeah.
What Truman did is he set up an entirely hidden system of finance that is entirely off the books and not subject to congressional review. So he puts the intelligence agent. So in other words, Truman has created a huge secret that he's got to keep. And with all of these congressional committees, you know, McClellan and all these people poking around trying to figure out what the heck is going on, this is a huge secret, I think, that in part lies at the heart of his response to these committees.
Yeah, Eisenhower described the American structure as the military-industrial complex. What Eisenhower left out was the military-industrial and spook complex. That account is factual, what Farrell is saying. This is what Truman did. He created all these, and most of the agencies were off the books for years. The National Security Agency was off the books for about 20 or 30 years. Didn't exist.
Martin, I suppose we could also look at this business of bringing these private bankers in as well to Intelligence Nexus. That was quite new, wasn't it? I mean, that at the time, I mean, that what had happened was between the wars, both America and Britain had developed their offices of economic warfare, which were separate to intelligence agencies. But really, after World War II, the Americans, and I imagine the Brits too, started bringing them all together.
Well, I think the relationship between the banking elite and the intelligence services goes back before that, a long time before that. But of course, what Truman did at the end of the war was really soup it up to a completely different level. And one of the other things he did, which is not mentioned in any of that, is they got into the drug dealing business in that era as well, because they funded their support for the nationalist Chinese. Congress didn't want to fund a civil war in China. If they'd gone to Congress and said, we want to fund a civil war in China, they said, no, we've got better things to spend our money on. So the first thing they had to think, how can we fund the nationalist Chinese? And the thing they came up with was, well, we're going to fund them through through drugs. So that's when if you remember, if you know your history, you know, the jazz musicians all started to take heroin. It became a kind of, you know, thing that people in the ghetto used to do, but it was all actually being orchestrated by the intelligence services to fund their activities overseas. And it was a win-win from their point of view, because you know you get to be involved in the drugs trade, and you've got all this dirty money that you can then spend on all the other things you want to do. Don't have to account to anybody for it, and it's been going on ever since. And you know, it's Bank of Credit and Commerce International was you know, just one pimple on the top of that iceberg.
Nothing new under the sun. It's what we did, the United Kingdom, in the Opium Wars in the 1840s.
Tell you a couple of things that are new stories we still haven't covered. I always try and find stuff which I think should get much more coverage but doesn't. One is the Hurricane Michael destroying a whole load of F-22 Raptors in the United States. Climate change has done, apparently, what decades of warfare failed to achieve, destroying and damaging the US Air Force's F-22 Raptor fighters. US Air Force's Tyndall Air Base in Florida took a direct hit this week. Many of its ultra-advanced F-22 Raptor stealth fighters were caught on the ground. Exactly how many have been damaged or destroyed, but there are photographs taken. It looks like at least three or four have been upended and destroyed. The aircraft cost £475 million each, Martin.
Yeah, well, the other thing that's happening is a big question that I've been reading about is the F-35 capable of taking on the S-300 in Syria? And, you know, the Israelis...
Let's just not get off the point here, because what are they doing, allowing these planes to sit there and be upended, not sticking them in a hangar or somewhere where they're protected, or flying them away from the hurricane?
Well, that just means they'll have to buy more, which means more money to be spent and more money for the corporations that make the damn things. Every missile fired is a cash register going ching. So they'll all have to be replaced, won't they?
So if just four of these are seriously damaged, like the ones we can see a picture of here... that means £2 billion down the drain.
Well, it doesn't mean it's not down the drain for the people who supply the damn things, is it?
Yeah, they replace them.
Yeah, but it is for us. The other story is, I think, one of the big stories this week, which has hardly been talked about, is reported by Michael Crick on Channel 4 News. Was Tory MP Craig McKinlay overspent while standing against Nigel Farage? The Tory MP overspent more than twice the legal limit during his 2015 general election campaign while trying to stop the UKIP leader Nigel Farage becoming an MP. South Thanet MP Craig McKinlay, along with his election agent Nathan Gray and Conservative Party official Marianne Little, are on trial, alleged to have been in a conspiracy to defraud the election. This has really got hardly any coverage whatsoever, Kevin.
Scarcely. I saw Michael actually give it on Channel 4. It's got no legs at all. And there's the other one, which again got no legs, although the Observer reported it, about the fraud in Brexit. Your very own local Mr. Banks is frequently mentioned in that connection. And the police have been asked to investigate, and they've refused.
Do you think that there's this has become politicised now, the courts, and saying, well, one kind of election fraud is OK and another kind isn't, for example?
Apparently. That's what the evidence suggests, and it's the other side of the evidence. The courts in the United Kingdom know we're being spied on, and they know it's criminal, and they're doing nothing.
Since you're here, can you give us the short version of the Irish border? It would seem to me absolutely obvious that if the UK leaves the EU, there will have to be a hard border along the Northern Ireland border. Like when I used to live there, there was a massively hard border. But I mean, you know, what's your take on this whole Irish border issue?
The Irish border is a complete and utter fiction. You know, there aren't even, you're now going into Devon or Cornwall, there are no markers at all. And it's a wonderful Irish invention. It doesn't exist, so everybody rows about it. But if it's restored physically, it will be a catastrophe mostly for Arlene Foster's constituency. They will lose money. And
surely it's got to happen. If Northern Ireland is going to stay with the UK, it's got to happen, hasn't it?
Well, Northern Ireland voted to remain in the Union, in the European Union. The politics there are very tricky.
Can I just also add that Theresa May agreed with the EU that if we did leave the single market and the customs union, that Northern Ireland would have separate arrangements.
She might just have to rein back on that.
Well, she's already agreed it.
Yeah, but she might have to rein back on it. Martin, I know you've got very strong views about this. Yeah. It just seems to me, you know, if the Northern Ireland is going to stay with Britain, then they're going to have to be a border. It just seems absolutely blindingly obvious.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, hopefully, it'll be Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Our sister show Dialects on next Tuesday at noon, where you can hear all about... Actually, I should have told you a little bit about that earlier. We'll hear a bit more from Bristol Housing Action and Richard Carey, but also from the author of Bombs for Peace, George Samueli. He pulls the former Yugoslavia conflict apart and explains why he believes Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic was assassinated by the, or at least presents evidence he was, by the International Criminal Court. You can download Dialect online now at dialectradio.co.uk. Apologies for this week's show. Still trying to get a response from our manager Pat as to what happened. It didn't go out for some reason. But anyways, it hopefully will. You can always get it online if you can't get it by other means. So, there you'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. I'll leave you with a Brexit song from Meg Lee Chin. And don't let the banksters get you down. Are there any humans?
World going mad, many souls propping up just one face. Island Nation makes a dash for the door, chicken bones and feet in a really slow pace. Tell the bone to your mouth, close your eyes and go to sleep. Don't think nothing at all while the shadow people come looking in and destroy you.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.